Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching in Life. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. Und in der heutigen Folge unterhalte ich mich mit einer meiner Lehrerinnen, mit der Yoga- und Buddhismuslehrerin Michelle Low. Und es ist ein Austausch, der sowohl vom Thema als auch vom Feeling her pure Freude beinhaltet. Viel Spaß damit. Herzlich willkommen nochmal hier in dieser neuen Folge Meditation Coaching and Life. Eine der schönsten Sachen, die dieser Podcast mit sich bringt, ist, dass ich mich mit Menschen unterhalten kann, Menschen interviewen kann und Menschen auch auf den Zahn fühlen kann im schönsten Sinne, die mich inspirieren, die mich begeistern und wo ich einfach Fragen habe oder einfach Menschen, denen ich gern zuhöre, Menschen, mit denen ich mich gern austausche und von denen ich auch glaube, dass das, was sie machen, dass das, was sie erzählen und das, was sie in die Welt bringen, ganz großartig ist. Nicht nur für mich, sondern auch für dich, wenn du zuhörst und für uns alle. In dieser Folge spreche ich mit Michelle Low. Michelle Low würde ich, obwohl sie das selber abstreitet, aber ich würde sie als eine meiner Lehrerinnen bezeichnen und so ähnlich wie Turiya Hannover, mit der ich hier auch vor einigen Wochen im Podcast gesprochen habe, ist sie eine der Personen, die mich in den letzten Jahren sehr begleitet hat. Ich bin auch sehr froh, dass es so ist, denn das war und ist natürlich die ganze Zeit von Pandemie, Shutdown und Lockdown und global alles verrückt und so weiter. Und da hat es mir wahnsinnig gut getan, bestimmte Anker zu haben in meinem Alltag. Denn ich hatte ja keinen Job oder ich habe ja sowieso keinen Job, zu dem ich irgendwie regelmäßig hingehe und Konzerte sind weggefallen und Live-Speakings sind weggefallen und so weiter. Und auch für mich war so eine gewisse Regelmäßigkeit sehr gut und sehr wichtig. Und da habe ich einen sehr, sehr, sehr intensiven Kurs, einen intensiven Studienkurs belegt bei Bob Thurman, den ich ebenfalls hier in dem Podcast schon interviewt habe. Kann ich auch nur empfehlen, die Folge. Und Michelle Low. Michelle ist Lehrerin aus Portland, Oregon in den USA für Yoga, ganz traditionell Hatha Yoga, aber auch tibetisches Yoga und für Buddhismus. Sie arbeitet seit knapp 10 Jahren sehr eng mit Bob Thurman zusammen, hat aber auch in Portland ihre eigene Schule. Sie unterrichtet Hatha Yoga, Yoga Nidra, worüber wir auch sprechen werden, und wie gesagt verschiedene Aspekte des tibetischen Buddhismus. In diesem Gespräch quatschen wir darüber, was pure Freude ist, darüber, was unsere grundlegende Natur, unsere Originalnatur als Mensch eigentlich ist, was das Ganze mit purer Freude und Verzückung zu tun hat und warum es uns so oft so schwer fällt, das in unserem Alltag zu sehen. Wir sprechen darüber, was die Yoga-Sutren von Patanjali und anderen dazu sagen und was der Buddhismus dazu sagt. Wir sprechen darüber, wie sie als Yogalehrerin quasi absolut wie die Jungfrau zum Kind gekommen ist und eigentlich gar nicht Yogalehrerin werden wollte, sondern wie sie Yoga eigentlich als Reha-Maßnahme nach einem schweren Autounfall entdeckt hat. Und wie sie dann auf einmal ein großes Yoga-Studio und mehrere Yoga-Studios und ganz viele Angestellte hatte und was das mit ihr gemacht hat. Wir sprechen darüber, wie sie Bob Thurman kennengelernt hat, wie sie in Indien mit dem Dalai Lama dann zum Buddhismus gefunden hat. Wir sprechen über Schlangen und über buddhistische Wesenheiten. Wir sprechen über ganz konkrete Dinge des Lebens und aber auch über ganz abstrakte philosophische Ideen. Und wir sprechen vor allem darüber, dass Yoga anscheinend wohl aus dem Buddhismus kommt. Und dass es dafür Beweise gibt und dass diese Beweise jetzt gerade erst gefunden worden sind und was das bedeutet. Und wir sprechen zu guter Letzt auch darüber, wie sie gemeinsam mit Bob Thurman Yoga und Buddhismus zusammenbringen und warum das klappt und warum das ganz toll ist. Es ist ein Gespräch, in dem wahnsinnig viel los ist, in dem wahnsinnig viele Begriffe auch fallen, die ich zum Beispiel, der sich nicht so sehr mit Yoga auskennt, teilweise auch nachgucken musste. Ich habe immer mal wieder auch eingehakt und gesagt, okay, lass uns mal über den Begriff sprechen, über das. Aber wenn ihr möchtet, legt euch schon mal einen Zettel und einen Stift bereit, weil da ist ganz schön viel Information drin. Ich freue mich wahnsinnig, euch Michelle Low vorstellen zu dürfen. Und wenn euch das begeistert und fasziniert und ihr auch einsteigen wollt in diese Welt, dann findet ihr in den Shownotes einige Links zu Online-Kursen, die Michelle gibt. Und auch, falls ihr in den USA seid oder vorhabt, in nächster Zeit mal hinzureisen, natürlich auch zu Live-Möglichkeiten mit Michelle zu connecten. Jetzt wünsche ich euch viel Spaß bei diesem Austausch der puren Freude.
Here we are. It looks good.
Great.
Hi. Dear Michelle, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking the time and also for taking the interest. And so thank you very much. we've now talked for almost over half an hour, and we sort of had to stop talking so we can carry on a bunch of the stuff that we're talking about into this podcast. But I would like to start off. I'm not even sure if I asked you the question when we started talking to each other. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm really full, you know, of so much work, and I feel a sense of abundance right now for even, you know, with all of the loss that my business had during 2020 and 2021, having a yoga studio, there were many different shifts that happened that brought a great amount of opportunity into my life. And so I feel really blessed right now and full, and maybe a little bit too much work, too much going on, but at the same time, I'm happy and I feel blissful. So I'm very, very blessed.
When you say you feel blissful, can you tell me what that means?
Well, to me, it's something that is not coming from something outside of me. And it's something that I have been connecting to in my practice for a long time. And I would say, you know, as I think you know, I know you know, that it's our original nature. You know, if you think about, like, I always like to think of a little newborn baby. And when the baby starts to, well, maybe not quite newborn, but when their eyes start to open and they start to take in the wonder-filled universe, and they start to look up with those big wide open eyes, and they smile and kind of move their head around, you know? And it's just a sense of joy that's innate. It's this luminosity of the mind that is free from the troubles, the traumas, the dramas, the triggers of what's going on in the world around you, and also within you when things are not very clear. So I think the blessing is of feeling bliss, bliss, a sense of, you know, completeness in my own inner being, of feeling of love that is in me, that doesn't need to come from something outside of me, but is also coming in plenitude from everything and everyone. So it's like a tapping in to the love in the universe and knowing that that love is also you. And it just feels ecstatic to be in vibration with it all.
When you're saying innate and you're saying it's the true nature and the nature of the universe, this is a very fundamental and earth-shattering or universe-shattering exclamation, right? It's a proclamation, because what it says is existence, the universe, and us human beings are essentially bliss. We are essentially fully aware, enlightened, wonderful, perfect, and so on. Yet, the world does not look like that, you know.
what we seem to be doing
is we seem to be rather chasing after moments of feeling happy or connected or something like that. Would you say that there's a fundamental difference between blissfulness and, like, you know, maybe happiness? If we can make such a distinction,
yeah. But I think that there is. I think everybody, well, although in happiness it's containing bliss as well, but everybody wants to be happy, but we have been So that's a given, and yet we're not. We're suffering, and mm-hmm. basically the state of things is that we're looking for things outside of us that to make us happy, and we're trying. And when we get them, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. And so then we're unhappy again. But the bliss that I'm talking about is, it doesn't shift up or down with what's happening, external to you. So I think, yes, happiness, because, right, the state, we equate happiness if things are going well for us.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. And we've just all been through, the whole planet has been through a major crisis, the pandemic. And many have died and many have suffered, and that's always been going on, but we were very intimately aware of it on the planet the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It was really in our face, and we had to, look at reality, so-called reality. But is not, that's not what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Right, this thing that in the state of suffering. Okay, so now I'm kind of losing my track of thought here.
No, that's perfectly fine. Yeah. We
the pandemic.
I'm also laying it on you, because I asked you how you are, and you said, yeah. Oh man, I'm yeah, doing well, and I feel bliss.
Yeah, I feel bliss.
So I guess why I'm also sort of starting to probe in that direction. It's because I met you a little less than 2 years ago, and I met you when I was taking a course with you and Bob Thurman in Hawaii, and it was a mixture of a teaching of Buddhist principles and philosophy and wonders, and it was also yoga, which I didn't participate in that much because I was super jet lagged and tired, and I had just suffered a gout attack, so I was like all out.
Oh.
So
I didn't
so anyways
know.
neither did I. I found out like later on. But the point is that one of the words and one of the themes that just kept on coming up was bliss. And it was that our original nature, to use another phrase, is this bliss. So meaning that we as human beings and all beings and nature and the universe is in essence wonderful, perfect, and blissful. And this has been a theme throughout these past 2 years that I've been studying with you and with Bob in the Vajra Yoga training and all this stuff. And this is really a theme that is coming again and again and again and again. And I love it and I feel it. But I also understand how people might listen and they might look at their own life circumstances and they say, well, if that is so, how come I so rarely and so seldomly experience this bliss? Like, how come life sucks a lot of times? How come it's hard a lot of times? And you were already sort of beginning to approach, part of an answer, by saying that has something to do with how are we trying to find this bliss? We are very outward oriented. It's like, and you said the wonderful phrase, when life is going my way, then it's easy to experience this, to feel happy. But I guess this bliss that we're talking about, it's not so much to do with, do you find 20 bucks on the streets and feel happy about it, But it's another thing.
Or the politics going your way, or the lover is treating you the way that you want them to, or you have. And even when people get the things that they think are going to make them happy, then it's very fleeting, isn't it? And then, then there's something else that they need. And then also the things that they thought were going to make them happy come with so many troubles, so many problems. If I only get that job or that relationship or that house or those things, but then I'll be happy. And there's, so then what it is that we're looking at objects, we think we're separate from the rest of the world, and we're looking at the things outside of us as they are sensory objects that we're either going to bring in or push away based on whether they're going to serve us and make us happy or make us feel uncomfortable, fearful, you know, or hurt. So we're constantly going back and forth with, you know, accumulating around us things that are either good and pushing away things that are bad. And then this does not, this is the whole ego project. And this is the very thing that yoga is, it points to right away, both in, you know, in Vajrayana Buddhism, but also in Hatha Yoga and classical yoga. It is that we have these hindrances to our original nature, to our bliss, which is that's that they all say this. And when you actually tap into it, you know, and a lot of people are now with different ways, psychedelic, different spiritual traditions, they're tapping in, they have an experience of it. Hopefully it gets them on a path to more of a permanent sense of it. But, you know, these, the kleshas or the obstacles or the hindrances are in classical yoga, say Yoga Patanjali, a little different than Buddhism, but I like it. And it really kind of worked well with the pandemic situation because you have, first of all, avidya, which is ignorance, not knowing your original nature as bliss, infinite, vast, you know, awaken, and not being able to see that. Then your separate sense of self, and you're not understanding that bliss comes when you connect with the interconnected nature of all things. When you realize that everything, there's an emptiness of any inherent existence. So you're connected with everything and everyone and intimately. And so when you let the boundaries go, that comes in. But the boundaries that we have, that we've been also told that we're, you know, this separate being, and it's kind of us against the world and and other beings. So, you know, and then that's the second of the obstacles. That is the separate sense of self. And it's called a smita. It's actually, you know, or ego, the translation for asmita, Sanskrit word for ego, is also sometimes called the ahamkara, which is your immune system. And the yogic texts don't say get rid of it entirely. They say it's important to have it there, but you want to make it clear and transparent or semi-permeable so things come in and out, but without a disturbance. And without, you know, clinging or grasping to anything. So then the next two of the obstacles of the five kleshas are raga, which is attraction and clinging to, you know, good things, happy things. Oh, you meet somebody and you suss them up and you suss them out and you say, oh, I think you could make me happy. You know, I mean, you're looking. I mean, even how we have, I haven't done the dating apps, you know, I'm happily married, but so I've been married for 20 years now and I missed the dating app phenomena. But, you know,
me and my wife, we say the same thing. We came along just when this dating app thing happened. So it's like none of us, I've literally never seen Tinder from the, I've never even seen what it looks like.
Me either.
I'm from before yesterday.
And I don't really, but I think it's just so, you know, what I understand, like even if they just swipe, you know, swipe right, swipe left, I don't know which way it goes, but the thing is that you're just, it's a reject right there. And even in the app, it's a rejection or an acceptance. I like it. I don't like it. This person could make me happy. They fit my criteria. These people don't over here. So you put everybody into kind of these boxes, and that's considered to be the number one obstacle to realizing your original nature of bliss. So is it the attraction and the aversion? So that after the attraction comes aversion or hatred or pushing away anything that you don't like. And there's all sorts of levels to that. And then the last one is fear of dying. You know, the big one is abhinavesha, fear of dying. And that's not just fear of the physical body dying, which we all had very intimately, you know, in the pandemic, but it's also of our sense of self, and that starting to dissolve away. And so, and that's, of course, as you know, when you start to get into deep, you know, meditation and meditative states, there's always that place where you start to lose the sense of your body or your sense of, you know, direction. You can't tell where you are anymore. In fact, you start to lose your head. And then that's right when the practice begins. But, you know, I think Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said it's the practice is like falling out of an airplane, but without a parachute, but with the good news that there's no ground to land on anyway. And that's that sense of, you know, dissolution. Yeah, it's a great quote. And it really does sum
that up. I read something today which totally connects with this. And maybe we can linger here for a little moment. We're talking about the fear of dying, right? And it's twofold. It's the fear of, you know, physically dying, leaving the physical body. But it's also maybe a fear of dying to your beliefs, dying to your expectations, dying to your fixed sense of this is me, this is who I am.
Yes.
And then a spiritual practice or something like that comes along and challenges this and tells you, well, is that really true? Are you really this unchangeable person? Is it really this, well, that's just me, you know, that's nothing, right. You know, that, and I am how I am, and, you know, something like
or
that.
People
is that really
don't
true?
Change. People never change. You know, that's what we also hear.
Or me, and yeah, yes, exactly. And then there's this challenge to that. And what I heard today is, it's sort of like a poem, I forget by who it was by, and it was talking about sort of a spiritual journey. And the poem was like, okay, so the man or the woman, I don't know who it is at home and is making the house for the guest. Like, you know, cleaning up the house, cleaning up the rooms, making the bed, putting on the tea kettle. But the guest never comes. The guest doesn't appear. And then the night arrives and the person gets tired and they see shadows, you know, outside and they don't know what to do. And all of a sudden the guest appears and the person is terrified. So, and this sort of, I took this as sort of a parable for this. It's like, we're doing yoga, we're doing meditation, and we're like, yeah, I want to get enlightened. Yeah, I want to have, you know, a great experience. I want to lose myself or whatever, but it doesn't happen because life, you know, because, you know, life happens and we're too stuck and whatever. And then, you know, when it happens, it's very dark and shadowy. And then when something appears, you get super afraid. You've prepared all your, you've done the practice, but then something happens. And this is sort of maybe the fear of, well, that, the guest is not this shiny, happy person coming with a nice Rimowa suitcase and, you know, and a bouquet of flowers and a plate of cheese, maybe,
that's,
you know,
right.
But the guest is some scary person that comes at night.
And they give you a plate of rocks.
It in your face.
It's not, they're not giving you the flowers and the good stuff. And that's definitely a stage, you know, and whether it's, you know, we call it the dark night of the soul in some traditions, but it's that rite of passage in many spiritual traditions, and it's it is a bit scary. In fact, I was telling my students Sunday morning I taught a class, but before that, I woke up early, and I did some meditation, and then after meditation, I felt like lying down and doing yoga nidra, and I went in and did another 90-minute. Session of my of a sleep yoga practice where I really did start to go back into, you know, the sleep and dream state. And I got to a point, and this is the same as when we're starting to fall off into sleep at night, where we hit the clear light. And if you're present for it right before, there is a feeling of going into darkness or losing yourself completely. You can't find yourself. And I actually had, and this hadn't happened to me for a long time, but I had a sense of fear that I was falling off mm-hmm. and I couldn't find my body and couldn't find any sense of direction. And it was that total darkness. But because I had the practice, you know, the seed of that had been planted to say, stay in that imminent stage and trust that we're, you know, that what's to come is the bliss of the clear light entry. And, but it was kind of a good, it was a good thing, because that fear of falling or fear of dying, when you do access, it is a sign that your practice is, that you're getting somewhere. And in a certain sense, when you talk about the yoga practitioner doing all of that preparation, you know, cleaning the house and making the tea and doing all those things, and expecting it to be something really, you know, blissful and great and happy right away when it comes, but they it doesn't turn out that way. There's this other thing that has to happen. But however, that was still an important part of the journey to make those preparations. And, you know.
Yes. And you just mentioned yoga nidra, and you also mentioned the clear light, and these are two things I wanna you know, look at a little bit. Just a few weeks back, I've had a conversation in this podcast with a palliative nurse, whose job it is to accompany people when they are dying. You know,
yes.
In both in the days and weeks and months leading up to death, but also very, very closely in the actual moments and process of actually
yes.
ceasing to be alive. And we spoke about how Buddhism has, especially Tibetan Buddhism, has certain teachings regarding the process of dying, and how there is the idea that you can use your lifetime while you're here and while you're awake and while you're breathing and kicking to sort of familiarize yourself with with what it's like to die, so that in the moment when the guest comes, you know, whichever form it takes, you're sort of you're not so much startled, you're sort of a little bit prepared or something, you know.
That's right.
And now you're talking about this, and so I would like to, you know, ask you, since you are very, very much the person, together with Bob, who has been teaching me exactly this, has been teaching me these things, teaching me about yoga nidra, about clear light, about the stages, the dissolution stages, and so on. So I would like to pass this over to you, and maybe you can speak a little bit about it as much as you can or as possible, about what is the idea behind this process of dying in Tibetan Buddhism, and how is it connected to this thing that you just mentioned called clear light? What is that even about? And how does that connect to yoga nidra? I know it's a big question, but I'm
first,
sure.
First, I kind of, yeah. I'm still back, and I will get to that, but I'm still sort of back there with this nurse that you have, the palliative
yes.
care nurse, because I also am a fan. I don't know if you've heard of Zach Bush, but he's you'll have to have him on your podcast. He's really quite brilliant, and I'll send you a link to him. But he's also a hospice care doctor, and mm-hmm. he worked in emergency rooms and things like that. And so he had many people that, of course, you know, they brought them back. There was one interview I heard with him where he said there was one night in the ER where they had four different people that they resuscitated and brought back from having passed on into death and clinically dead. And mm-hmm. they came back, and they all said the same thing to him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very common. Why did you bring me back? You know,
mm-hmm.
and they were all very different people. One had been he was a pastor and had a couple of hundred people in the hospital room in the weeks before, all saying goodbye to him. And he was a very quite happy man. And there were some others that had a lot of pain and pain in their bodies.
Yeah.
You know, so they were in different situations, but they all said
mm-hmm.
that same thing. And he talked also about how they're also, and I wonder if the palliative care nurse spoke up to this as well, that there is similar, always the same, as the person is starting to enter into the stages of dissolution. They're going into what's called, you know, to clinically dead. Then it's beautiful. As they enter into that moment where their breath stops, so they take their last breath and they move in to the space between, it's just so beautiful. And what the people that are there with the dying person witness is this this light and this beauty. And the person that comes back from it, it has already, you know, had that experience of entering into that beauty and that light. So, and it was really, what was another thing that he had said that also was so poignant about what's happening on our planet right now, in a certain sense of the climate crisis and things, you know, people being distraught and hopeless because things look so bad out there. You know, if you listen to the media and if you just look at what's happening to Gaia, it's very intense and you can kind of spin out, you know, into depression thinking about it, on how will we ever recover. And I saw this doctor with very sad eyes talk about the planet in that same way, and that human beings, if we didn't get our act together, that there's like maybe 60 or 80 years or something like that before we aren't here anymore. And he said that potentially that same way that people in the weeks before they actually die start to make these major shifts in clarity, thinking about what's important to them, who they loved, can they make amends, can they, they're reaching out to people in their life, apologizing and connecting, and then actually going through the dying process again, taking them into a place of such beauty. And he said, wouldn't it be amazing if the people on this planet, if it is too late, that collectively we do all kind of come through that same sort of process and get it together and figure out what's really important and learn how to love each other with the time that we have left. And then pass on, because the thing is then with Buddhism and, you know, with the clear light, is that we are not, that this is, there is an everlasting life where there's no end. There is a continuum. Yes. And so that's why
different from afterlife. It's different from the Christian notion of I leave this state and I go into some other kind of state where it's some afterlife or some paradise or something like that. It's a different idea. It's an idea of a stream of continuous existence which constantly just transforms.
That's right. Right. It's constantly transforming. So that sense of like soul, right? The soul, what isn't the difference is that it's not a fixed thing that doesn't interact with environment. I mean, it can't, because it is actually moving in and connecting with, there's just no possible way for it to be isolated. So because it is connecting with other things, it is then changing. It's because of its relative nature. It's always in change. So it doesn't, like the Buddha didn't say that there isn't a soul, but that there isn't a permanent fixed sort of soul that is separate from everything else. And so because it isn't separate, it is constantly in change during that continuum process. So, and that's...
It's a very scary thought, I think, for many people who would love to hold on to some infinite self to some infinite right. well. If I die, my soul lives on, or something like that, you know. But it might be a scary. I think it's very comforting actually to think that too. There is no such thing.
And maybe that's where the whole problem comes with that we never change. You know, I can't change, or you know, other people don't change because of that sort of fixed thing. But we can. We are constantly transforming. And then, if you're on a spiritual path, if you have a method towards transformation, I mean, I don't even can't even remember. It's already in my lifetime. It seems like multiple lifetimes, because the Michelle that was growing up and then the Michelle now, you know, they're very different beings. So. It's I'm really excited about that. I like what she's become. I'm really excited about what she's going to be doing, you know. And if it's on this planet another 10, 20, 30, or, you know, who knows, maybe more, I don't know if lucky or not, because I'm not really worried about it anymore. You know, tomorrow you say, I was just doing a podcast with her and she got hit by a bus and now she's gone. And
that would not be cool.
It wouldn't be cool.
Don't get any ideas.
But I'll still be cool. You know, I'll be cool because I'm not worried about where I'm going to the next, you know, the next thing. And that's exciting too. So
this leads me to a thought that the nurse, her name is Teresa, that she said that how people die has a lot to do with two things. One of them is acceptance, acceptance of the fact that it is happening and it will happen, yes. Which brought me back to this Buddhist also idea of, well, you will die.
Yes.
You know, like you might as well recognize it today. You will die. And the moment of death is completely uncertain. So that's don't right. live like you're going to live forever. And the second part also seemed very Buddhist to me. And she said, the way people actually experience these last moments before dying has a lot to do with what their beliefs and what their training or where they are mentally and psychologically and maybe spiritually in regards to what it means to die. So she says that people who come from a very strict, let's say Christian heaven and hell kind of background, a lot of times do have a harder time because they might get afraid. She says that some other people who might not even have anything to do with religion, but some people who have sort of in their lives, as you mentioned, made amends, tried to be a good person, have also made amends with themselves, forgiven themselves for a lot of things. She said they tend to have a much more peaceful process of dying, which also connects to this Buddhist idea of like, A, you're going to die, B, you never know when, and C, the only thing that helps you when you die is your practice, meaning like what you have done in your life to develop a good relationship to yourself, other people, death, existence, you know?
Yes. Absolutely. I can see that being so true. And one of the things about the practices in Buddhism, the yogas in Vajrayana Buddhism, is that they are preparations for this very thing. So actually all of the, you know, the sadhanas are for the continuum. And so the night yogas, you know, a preparation for it. And that's, you know, if you want me to speak much on the bardo, I have to say get Bob back on your podcast, because I'm still, you know, a new student of the bardo yogas, and to really talk about it. But yes, the dissolutions of consciousness and then going into these stages that lead us into what's called clear light, which is our original nature, and it is blissful. So
so as you talked about the Michelle that you are today, it seems like very distant from the Michelle that you were growing up. Can you tell me a little bit about just you and your journey, and how did you find your spiritual practice? How did you connect with yoga? How did you connect with these things? Like, how did that come into your life?
Right. Well, so first of all, if I take it back to being to my childhood, I had a pretty rough, childhood. I had not an easy upbringing and a lot of strict discipline, and also some discipline that the family has apologized for now. My mother says even, that would be considered abuse, so she's actually, fortunately, as I did my healing, I think she was then put in a situation to, look at things. And so, and also make amends, which is really beautiful. But because of that, when I was little, my mother was actually Protestant and my father was Catholic, and there was a lot of religion in the household. And I was an actually very loving to God, very devoted little kid. But I also remember at the earliest age thinking that, how did I get here? How am I in this family? And how am I in this female body? I'm a man, and what am I doing in this? So I had some past life memories that now make a lot more sense. I also was plagued with the sleep paralysis for many years, where I would, where the body, and I think, this, many people get this, and there are explanations for it, but the body
seems to be a very scary thing.
Yeah, it is really scary. You wake up, you can't feel, you can't move your body, and you are able to see things, but you can't move. So that was also happening a lot. And so I would really, those times where I was feeling held down and not able to move and not able to breathe, and see myself there, I really would go into a lot of prayer. I really did devote myself to, and that was partly the training of Judeo-Christianity, to look at, for God to help me. And yet I didn't see happiness in my home. There was not happiness in the family. And to me, there was a lot of hypocrisy in regards to the way I was being treated and the way other people around me were being treated, and in the name of God. So I left home and went to university and started to study literature. And I even remember a Bible as literature class, poking holes through, Moses couldn't have written the first five books of the Bible and these various things. And I just thought, right on. And I'm going to be an atheist, and started to study things like, Sartre. And, But I did love, the existentialists. And so I was connected a lot to philosophy and trying to then heal, and used a lot of psychotherapy and did things to try to work with healing from the traumas and the dramas of my youth and my relationships with my family, my parents. And then I got into a really bad auto accident. And before that, I hadn't had...
How old were you then?
I was 23, and that accident, the car was totaled and had a great deal of physical pain for a couple of years, needed some surgeries. And so in the process of recovering from the accident, I asked my medical doctor, what more can I do? He was going to do the surgery, but it was a couple months out and I was in a lot of pain. And he said, oh, my wife, I think almost to get rid of me. He said, oh, my wife swears by yoga. Well, there wasn't a lot of yoga in Portland, Oregon, where I was living. I mean, really wasn't, we had it in the 70s and then most of it died down and there was just a little bit left. And I found somebody to do a yoga class, and it was very classic Indian style yoga, where it wasn't like today where we're constantly changing up sequences and moving flows around, but it was a set sequence. And so we did this basic sequence over and over. And it even included headstands and things that you would think are not good for whiplash and everything else that I had going on. But I didn't know that because there wasn't a lot out on it. And so I just tried everything and I started to feel better. In fact, so much better that it radically transformed my life. And I started to feel I got out of depression. And I got not just the physical body pain, but this, I had gotten to a place where I really thought that I wanted to end my life, you know, had that experience. So yoga really saved my life. And I started to practice it. So every day I did everything that the teacher said, and I loved it. And I went every day to practice. And 6 months after getting really into it, my teacher's husband got a job in Montana. And she said to me, I want you to take over the class, teaching my class. And I said, wow. How can I possibly teach the class? I don't have any training. I don't know how to do it. And she said, you do. You have, you know, in your heart, you know it. And you're just going to do the sequence and I'll write some things down. And I said, well, I need a certification or something, you know, some sort of license to do this. And she said, well, I'll make you one. And so she wrote out like from the Meghananda School of Yoga to me, and she wrote made me a little certificate. And I started teaching this class with it really without knowing anything. But I did know I was teaching love, you know, I was teaching my love for it, and it was coming out through the practice. And back then, you know, it was like early 90s. And so people were bringing in, it was a donation class as well. They would bring donations in, some money. Sometimes I made more money than I do these. but they'd bring in money. I would play, you know, emo music in the class, and they would, sometimes it was fruit, and sometimes they'd make me also like mixed CDs or tapes. It was tapes back then. So that was it. And so I did that for a long time. And then I one day got the eyes to see, to really look out at the students when I got over myself. And I could tell that, person does looks kind of uncomfortable there. That one over there looks, you know, maybe they could do something different. So I really just decided that I needed to actually go get some formal training. And I did begin to work with the Iyengars and some of the masterful teachers. Adil Palkavala was one. And I went to India and I also worked there, and I got a lot of really great training. And the thing is that when I went back in to teach the students after getting the technique training, the glasses tended to get a lot smaller till I could eventually figured out that you have to find this balance between technique and abandoning technique. And so maybe back again to our original, you know, like you can do all the preparations and you can get it a certain way, but ultimately you have to surrender. And actually, that's one of the definitions of yoga. It's Patanjali says you have to practice, do abhyasa, and have these techniques, and you have to have vairagyabhyam, you know, a sense of renunciation, a surrendering of things. So you can't, you know, you can't do it all on your own. And there's just even that feeling of, you know, kind of getting out of the way as a teacher and allowing people to just be in their bodies and move and be in their breath. So, yeah, so that was it. And I never looked back, even with the Iona studio. And at one time I had a couple of locations and I may again, that always kind of came. Most of my life has been, with the studio, same thing, just like the first teacher leaving. And, you know, the woman who used to own the studio that I eventually ended up teaching in, she said, I would like you to take over my studio. I'm retiring. And so she gave me the studio. And it was a little more complicated story, but I won't bore you with it. But so it came to me. I didn't really ever want to run a yoga studio. I wanted to practice more and I loved teaching. But then I ended up having the the you know, the practice of running a business and taking care of people in a different way.
How was that transition to actually have that responsibility?
It's not easy. I mean, I think it's one of the hardest things to do. And it, you know, it definitely made me grow up. Because when you have a business and you have employees and you have other people that, you know, are relying on you and, you know, all of the things that we've had to deal with. I mean, I had early days, we had an audit for the use of independent contractors instead of employees. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to deal with things like that, just regular everyday sort of business things. And then in the pandemic recently, you know, owning a yoga studio, there was so much that was put upon us that way in regards to stress and how are we going to do the right thing for people, keep people safe? Should we close it down? Should we keep going? Pivoting to online business versus, you know, in studio business. So that's also been, you know, it's really tough. It's not, I have a tendency to want to go to the cave and, you know, and to practice and, but that's the yoga of running life, you know, doing your work, being a householder versus a yogi that's practicing full time. That to be engaged in a compassionate way, to have what we call upaya, you know, skillful means or the art of actually serving and meeting people in a way that is that's coming in with wisdom and with love in all circumstances is you know, that's the practice.
Which part of the journey did you encounter the more Buddhist meditative practices? Like, how did that come about? It's you know, of course, yoga has, you know, some styles of yoga, depends on where you go. You know, they do have a lot of meditation and a lot of, you know, spiritual practice in some sort of way. But, you know, you could easily also just be content with that or stay in that tradition. How did you encounter this Buddhist thing? How did you feel that in yourself?
So first of all, I have to say that I was also very blessed to meet the great Hatha yogi Richard Freeman as my longtime Hatha teacher, and Richard always taught philosophy from a very, you know, non-denominational, non-sectarian way, and he's sort of a Buddhist at heart because he loved the Buddhist teaching. So Richard often would teach, you know, yoga sutras, classical yogic texts, Hatha Pradipika, Bhagavad Gita in from a Buddhist slant and leading us to emptiness, right? Rather than a duality, you know, the yogi and God, then it would be, instead it would be that there would be the non-dual understanding of the divine and the yogi, right? So Richard was kind of introducing those concepts and that really resonated with me. So in a sense, he was laying the groundwork for 20 some years of studying philosophy and yoga with Richard. And we would also, when I'd go to Boulder a few times a year, we would go to the center that Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche started, which had different names, but ended up as the Shambhala Center. So I was having, and I would often go to Upaya Zen Center for meditation retreats. I did Vipassana, but I did not consider myself a Buddhist. I considered myself outside. I didn't. So that was another thing about the upbringing, that the Catholic and... Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, I lost your picture, but that's okay. I can't see you anymore, but that's okay.
I see and hear you.
Okay, cool.
Fine. Hopefully it's
gonna
come back.
Yeah, it says it's recording. So you know, I was really, I didn't want to, I saw a lot in yoga, in the yoga world, where there was Oh, same thing that I saw with the Protestants and the Catholics. You know, our system, okay, our tradition is better than yours. And mm-hmm. And to me, this sort of, you know, this wasn't yoga. And mm-hmm. so, you know, Richard Freeman was somebody that to me seemed like a teacher that really got that as well. And so I worked with him. And I loved all the traditions, but again, I stayed outside of the sort of what I thought would maybe be, you know, if I join Buddhism. And I also had the false sense, a false understanding of Buddhism. I thought that it must be a religion, right? Yes, I loved the Buddha. I loved the Buddha's teachings, but I didn't understand that it was a science and a method for liberation. And you could apply it to any religion. If you have a religion that you know, I love the Dalai Lama says you should follow your grandmother's religion, you know, and stick with that. But rather than converting, he never wants to convert. yeah, that's okay. You know, I know, me too. But I didn't want to do that. So, okay. So then cut to 2012. Mm-hmm. I built out my current yoga studio, and I was very busy that year, and I didn't apply early, as you always had to do at that time, for Richard Freeman's big training. And so I was looking for something else to do, and Richard and Bob were teaching, Bob Thurman were teaching the Buddha and the Yogis courses, and they were doing one at Menla. And I said, well, okay, I guess I could go to that. I don't know about the Buddha and the Yogis thing, but I want to go to my yoga training. But so I had a little bit of confusion about whether that was the right thing for me or not. And I even watched a YouTube recording of them doing a previous talk. And yeah, I thought it was okay. But then I went to Menla, and the very first night I walked in and I just got hit. I got hit with Bob Thurman's field, and there was something about him and something about the place. It might have been the Dalai Lama's field. I've had a lot of interesting dreams about His Holiness the Dalai Lama when I've been at Menla. And in fact, he did stay there. And I had a dream before knowing about what had happened in the preparations for his stay. I had the exact dream about it. So I've come to find out later on that I was tapping in the timeless time to his stay there. But I was hit by something. And then I heard Bob talk with Richard, and I just really fell in love with him and his teachings. And there was something about him that just spoke to me and spoke to my heart. And it was really true. It was like, right on, this guy really gets it. And he gets it in such a real way. And and I was super excited. And I actually didn't ever think, because of the great blessing of having really found my teacher, of, you know, this is a blessing to find somebody that you resonate with and that you can trust. And I had that in Richard, and I wasn't looking for another teacher. And this guy just pops in, and I thought, wow, well, I can really study with him. So then I'm excited. The next day I head out to check out the Menla grounds. And it had rained a lot that year, but it was a sunny day, and it was kind of early summer, but it was nice out. And there was a lady, Menla has a pool, and there was a lady in the pool. And I went to check out the pool, and I looked into the pool and said hi to her. And there was a dead frog on one end. And then there was a snake at the bottom of the pool. And the snake was moving around. Yeah, proper snake. And I said to her, hey, I think that's a snake. And she's like, she's swimming, you know, towards the snake. No, that's not a snake. It's just, you know, probably stick or something. And then some other people came in, and they also were swimming around, and they got near. I said, I think that's a snake. And I'm sure at that point it's a snake. And and I actually really love snakes. And that's part of, you know, also I knew about from Hatha yoga and from Ashtanga yoga, the Nagas are also very prevalent, and Shiva wears the snakes around his arm. So, you know, I knew that, I didn't know that the Buddhists liked them too that time. But I went and got a net in the corner and got the snake out of the pool and started taking it over to a little stream nearby. And Michael Burbank, the director of Menla, came by right at the moment I was putting it into the stream. And he said, "Oh my goodness, you have a Naga." And when the Dalai Lama stayed here and he saw a great Naga here, and he said that we really have to take care of the baby Nagas that are here as well. And, you know, they're sustaining this land, and to do pujas to the Nagas. And I was like, well, that's cool. You know, great. I have this Naga.
Can you explain briefly what a Naga is?
A Naga is, they sometimes are called snakes, but they are sustainers of the universe. In fact, maybe the best way to describe it is in the Sanskrit name. So one of the names for the king of the Nagas is Ananta Shesha. And Shesha is actually the word for residue, primordial residue. And so if you start to kind of go down and into the dissolution states to enter into, you know, into reality as clear light, you would be working with Shesha, right? So, and actually Richard loves to make a joke when he's teaching in Germany that he likes to say in Germany, they have a word that's really close to primordial residue, close to Shesha, the Sanskrit. Do you know what it is?
Scheiße.
Yeah, that's it. So it's the leftover stuff, right? It's the apana. So
I was
thinking
about shisha, actually, like the shishas, the shisha pipes.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I was like, no, that's not a German word. Yeah. So then I was like, yeah, scheiße. But of course, residue.
Yeah, residue.
Sure.
Yeah. Down all the way down, you know, to the particular. So, right. So that's... So they're considered to be the holders of the universe, and they're not very happy right now with what we're doing to the planet Earth. They also live underwater, under oceans, and so all the pollutants and things like that aren't good.
But here you are rescuing the baby Naga.
I was rescuing a baby Naga, and then a few hours later, I walk in to hear their next talk. And I hadn't met Bob Thurman yet. And I walked in and I saw this man that had found saw me with the Naga, talking to Bob. And then he said, "There's the woman that found the Naga." And Bob runs over. I mean, he really did. He scurried over to me and he said, "Well, I'm Robert Thurman and it's so nice to meet you. And thank you for saving the Naga, and they're so important here." And he tells me the story about His Holiness. And then the next thing out of his mouth was, "Would you like to come to the Kala Chakra with me next year?" And I just said yes. And I had no idea what the Kala Chakra was. It's a high, called an unexcelled, often they call them highest yoga tantras of Vajrayana Buddhism. And I agreed on the spot to go, not knowing that it was in India, not knowing that it was going to be with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and that it would change my life, and that I would end up taking vows, and that I would, in His Holiness's presence, you know, in that field, be absolutely certain that I had come back home. And since then...
That's wonderful.
So yeah, to find all of the things that have come since on this path with the Buddha Dharma has just really been about coming home. I've seen all of the Hatha Yoga that I was practicing and the classical yoga that I was studying as preparatory practices. But now as I really start to get into the perfection stage practices of Vajrayana, I see that they're actually not even just preparatory practices. They're really sister practices or different forms. And what's really exciting now, Bob and I started a school called Vajra Yoga. And we're doing that because we feel how important it is that they come back together. And there are some...
So the idea of Vajra Yoga, of the school that you're starting, the program that you're starting, the school that you're starting, is actually to reunite or to remarry what so far is perceived as separate, like the more classical Indian, like, okay, this is yoga, this is hatha yoga, this is the postures and the movements and da-da-da-da. Oh, and the other thing is a philosophy, is a Buddhist thing and whatnot. But to really bring this together and to say, well, they come from the same sort of source.
They do. And in fact, very soon, the Amrita Siddha is going to be published. Sir James Mallinson, he is a great British Hatha yoga scholar, and he spent 5 years working on the translation, and also it got even bigger into that. They looked at 5 original source texts, the oldest, like the first text that we find Hatha Yoga in is called the Amrita Siddha. And that was always thought to be coming from the Shaivite traditions and the Hatha Yogis called the Nat Siddhas. And he found earlier translation that is Buddhist. So the earliest source of Hatha Yoga that we know now is Vajrayana Buddhist. And so that will be published this year. And Bob and I are also taking a course with him soon because he will be reading the whole Amrita Siddha. I can send you a link to the course, depending on when this comes out. I think you could probably still do a replay of it with Sir James Mallinson. And it's very exciting because the rest of the world is going to find out about the connection. And they did, what's really cool about this, it's not just that, okay, Hatha Yoga sources Buddhism and Buddhist, and so, that's that. Because actually the Amrita Siddha has maybe 3 main postures that we still use in perfection stage practices of Vajrayana.
So it does talk about specific postures, that's what you're referring to.
It does. It does. And also, the how-to, it gives a method for the yogi to be able to reach the bliss that we were originally talking about, that undissipated bliss and that inconceivable liberation into that immeasurable bliss, immeasurable happiness, immeasurable joy, all of that, right? So this is, it's a method for it, and it gives practices, and then it is the source for then all of a sudden, so that's 11th century, and then you get 12th to then the 14th century, you have then Hatha Pradipika and most of the asanas that we have today, and which also the Hatha Pradipika cites Vajrayana practitioners as part of the, the Maha Siddhas that are practicing. So it's mixed there at that point, but what's exciting is that a lot of the Hatha practices and the asanas that are presented in the text soon to follow in this big, renaissance of starting to move the body in transformational practices, seeing that, the body is just a microcosm for, the macro. And so they actually start to bring all of these different ideas in. So it's not just the Buddhist ideas. It gets peppered with other types of things, depending on which neighborhood they were in. They all in the southern India, in the monastic settings, they're all starting to put out, this is our take on it. And it's so exciting because right now we have a lot of separation between Buddhism and, as you say, you know, and Hatha yoga or classical yoga. They're not thought to be. In fact, I was getting a Kalachakra empowerment by Sakya Trizin in Seattle one time, and I was sitting next to a fellow who was he was Buddhist. He hadn't been exposed to yoga, and I said to him, he asked me what I was doing. I was putting a post or something up on my Instagram, something, you know, on a break. And he said, "Oh, you're a yogi. How can you be here practicing Buddhism if you're a yoga practitioner?" I mean, that he really, you know, that was the thought, like you just can't bring them together. And there's a lot of the also this thinking that we can't have, you don't want to create a cocktail. You don't want to, mix Hatha yoga with this over here. Well, actually, what they were doing at that time in those early texts, they were making cocktails. They were experimenting. They were figuring out what works for them. And in some ways, it's very similar to what's happened in Hatha yoga for the last, 100 years, but really so much so in the last 25, 30 years since I've been practicing. And so it's exciting, like, that we can have, you know, the principles, the path that the Buddha laid out, that, and the philosophy, and that it's to me a much more, how do I want to say it without pissing off the Hatha yogis? I just think it works way better. You know, it's just like the Buddha's path. It's not much different. I mean, really, Patanjali, and many will say, and others will get upset about this, but that, you know, he did also think that the Buddha's path was really great. And so he created the eight limbs from the Noble Eightfold Path, that he just made his version of it. And why not, if something really works? And for me, it works great. And so, you know, bringing them back in and mixing a little Hatha yoga, because we also know that sometimes in Vajrayana, the perfection stage practices, it's just like, okay, you're going to drive the chandali or the kundalini or the prana into the central channel by doing something as intense as lifting up in the air, crossing your legs in lotus and dropping down, right? Which is called a BEP. But you can do it that way, but you can also, through Hatha yoga schools, they got very refined in looking at ways to get prana and apana and the energies, the winds, and the body to be balanced and move into the central channel without having to be so forceful. So yes, the Tibetan yogas are really fantastic, but also there are so many wonderful ways that we've been able to work in Hatha yoga to get these balances to happen, and maybe in a gentler way, invite, you know, the purification of the channels and move the energy into the center. So I don't think, even, you know, loving the Buddha Dharma and loving Vajrayana, I wouldn't give up my Hatha yoga just because I think there's so many really fantastic things in Hatha yoga that help people's physical body, help their mental, emotional body. And so what we're doing with Vajrayoga is bringing the two together and saying they don't have to delude each other, but they can empower each other. They can sit side by side, and then we can really work at finding some freedom, you know, in our lives using these great practices.
And maybe they are super complementary, because maybe it's good to, you know, when you focus on your Hatha yoga practice, to also supplement with this more background or these other teachings and this meditation and this, maybe call it philosophy or inner science of Buddhism. And it's also maybe great if you're a meditator, you just sit around, you know, your hamstrings are non-existent, you know, to sort of get into the body, and then also understand that you're not just like moving your body, because, you know, you're not just like exercising, but you're also working with the same energies and the same things that you're working with in visualization practice or in meditation practice and so on. So to bring these two together, I think that's a wonderful thing. And it might open up, like, it might, how shall I say this? it might open up people to the idea that it's not separated. You don't have to pick one or the other, or you don't, it's not a conflict and so on. As in your own journey where you said, well, there you were always thinking, yeah, but I'm not a Buddhist and, you know, yeah. I'm listening, but I don't know, you know, I have this path or, you know, so to maybe soften these boundaries a little bit, you know?
Oh, most definitely. And the thing with the Vajrayoga school, and Bob Thurman's very clear about this, is that, you know, it's not to convert people to Buddhism, but just to, you know, work with the principles that really do help people find freedom from suffering. So, yeah, they can sit, you know, somebody could go, they might be introduced to, like, it seems like you were pointing to that you maybe decided to go really fully into Buddhism, even though, you know, the Dalai Lama doesn't recommend you convert because you loved it, you know, and that might happen to somebody. They might decide to go a little bit more deeper into it, but that's not what we're really trying to do with Vajrayoga. We're just allowing, it's very non-sectarian and open, and it's really what works for people to feel like they're coming back into that sense of bliss and love and their original nature, peace.
So I will most definitely, in the show notes, post a few links.
Yes.
If people want to connect with Vajrayoga. Of course, if people want to connect with you and your school, and also with what you're doing with Bob, with Vajrayoga. And I, of course, I know that there are some, you know, ideas and aspirations to also bring this across the pond to Europe at some point in time. But until then, one of the, if I may say so, positive effects of living in this crazy global pandemic has been that a lot of things that have not been available online are now quite easily accessible. Like, for example, one can sit down and have an intense 1 year or something training with you and with Bob, right, and to actually participate in this. And as I've done during the first lockdown time and so on, and I can just say it's even though it's been all virtual and it's been across the globe, it's been a very, very, very intense experience. So if people are curious about this, of this sort of harmonic meeting of Hatha Yoga and Buddhist, you know, the Buddhist tradition, you know, they can totally connect with that, you know, and they can sign up and they can take a class.
And in fact, the course that you did, you know, the 300 hour, and it was actually designed to be a Yoga Alliance teacher training. You can't take that course as a teacher training anymore because there aren't any live sessions with the teachers. But I can give you a link for if somebody wanted, some brave soul really wanted to dive in deep, because it was supposed to be 300 hours, but it probably ended up being 600 hours of 6, talks. 000. And yeah, it was just so much that we actually really pulled it. But I can give you a private link if somebody ever really wanted to hear all of the lectures that Bob gave and the course with, you know, Mary and Richard and myself teaching the yogas. And it was super
so vast
deep
and expanded. I was part of it and I'm still yeah, processing. There are still multiple parts of it I haven't even seen and gotten to and so on. And you know what? You know what I think though? I think something like this, it's like a wellspring of knowledge and wisdom and experience. And this is what I love about when you teach and when Bob teaches. There is just an overflowing generosity.
Yeah.
This is really something, because you feel like, I feel like, it's just so much generosity and so much sharing of all the knowledge and all the experience and all that stuff. It's no holding back. It's some caution. It's sometimes it's like, well, don't try this at home, or try it very slowly and do it with me, you know. But it's not like, you know, you're not ready for this, or we can't do that, or we can't talk about this, or something like that. It's a very crazy, generous outpouring of knowledge. So even if one might not participate in every live session and so on and so on. Just the sheer fact that it's available and the sheer fact that there are people out there like the two of you who are willing to sort of pour out this unceasing well of experience, knowledge, teaching and so on. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you for noticing and for caring, you know, and I don't think, I mean, definitely it's not for everyone. And what we realized through that is the course that we're doing this year and that we will design for another 300 next year, we're taking the best of, and so that we've distilled it down to the essential teachings. So from all of, and you would be interested in this since you haven't gotten through everything, that we've taken the best parts of those talks and we've put them in an order that somebody could really go through and learn, you know, in a very, you know, digestible way, the Vajrayoga course. So it's, we're polishing it up, but but what you got was, I think in a sort of a sense, it was like a pandemic masterpiece of, you know, teachings, just this abundance of teachings. Whether most people can't digest it all, it's just too big of a meal. But it really is, it was something.
I'm looking at it now, for example, and it's like it's three modules, and each one has like 500,000 different classes and teachings and add-ons, and you guys just kept adding to it, and it's like, oh, and we have this one and we're going to do this too, oh, and there's this intensive, we're going to throw this in, and it was just I can only say generosity.
Yeah, and at the end of it, Bob, who did turn 80 this last August, he said, I'm not going to do that again like that. I'm not going to teach those the three vehicles in that way. And so what he's doing this year, we got him to do just some Q&As. So we've distilled the best of, so people watch a couple of, you know, hour or so of video of the best of during the week. And then they submit their questions and they have reading. And then he's answering some questions on the Thursday talks. And that we think will happen probably in the future. But because it was so, even on him, it was just a giant offering. And at the end, and now what he wants to do is he wants to teach, you know, he wants to teach new things. He wants to teach the other tantra. So if somebody was really interested in going through this material or doing some of the preliminaries, then you could take the advanced practices with him, advanced courses that we're doing, like the Bardo course coming up. And we're going to be teaching in the spring, in March next year, the wisdom, it will be the female Buddhas and the wisdom Dakinis, focusing on one of my main practices, which is Vajrayogini. And we will in the fall, or in, sorry, in the, in May, be doing some of the father tantras, but he wants to focus on Yamantaka. So that will be coming in May, and we'll keep going, see what happens.
It's wonderful. I want to thank you again. I think we will have to do part two, because I have about 30 different things that I still want to explore with you, but I don't want to overload you also. But maybe if I might have a request.
Sure.
The first time I encountered Yoga Nidra was also through you. I had pretty much never heard of it before, which is very weird, but you know, of course, I never heard of it before. And then when we met for the first time for this in-person class and course that I took with you, you led us through sessions of Yoga Nidra. And this has been a very transformational practice for me. I fell in love with it right away. First of all, because I'm lazy and I'm able to lay down.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
It's pretty cool. But also because it is such an intense experience. It's very soft, but it's also intense. And it works with a state of your mind and your consciousness and your awareness, which is between waking and sleeping.
That's right.
And this is could you just, if you still have a few minutes, could you just say how you encountered this practice and what it did for you in your life?
Right. Well, first of all, I'll say that yoga nidra depends on who you're practicing it with. And of course, just mm-hmm. like other schools of yoga or types of yoga practices, there's so many different takes on it. So the lineages and the approaches are going to be really different. And what you find if somebody just hears your enthusiasm about this and gets on YouTube and, you know, mm-hmm. looks at yoga nidra, you might find something that you resonate with. And like me, my background with it was that I started with yoga nidra. I did for a long time. There was a teacher in my studio that taught Richard Miller's I Rest style of yoga nidra, which is very much connected to, I think, you know, in a way with classical yoga, Patanjali, and you work a lot with the opposing patterns. And I still use this form, but you work with opposing patterns. And so you try to hold, say, for instance, happiness mm-hmm. and sadness at the same time. First, getting into your body in a relaxed, restful state and getting to a place where you are, like you said, so relaxed that you're kind of between waking and sleeping. And yet you're still, there's that part of you that is awake and aware. And mm-hmm. as you perfect the practice, you can even get to a point where it's quite pure and pristine awareness mm-hmm. that is gazing at the experience. And so it allows you then to experience how your body can hold on to these things, and it can mm-hmm. hold on to the energy. We can start to witness, wow, what does happiness feel like in my body? Where does it arise? How does it feel? And become intimate with that. And then set that aside, move to the feeling of discomfort or sadness, or it could be pain. You know, you look for the opposite. And then in the yoga nidra classic practice that's used in IRS, where you bring them the two together. And then what generally happens is the mind can't hold on to them both simultaneously. As they arise together, there is this just pure release into emptiness. And so two things happen. You looking at it from an energetic sense, wow, this is just this thing that I was projecting onto, you know, the stories and the drama and the, what we call samskara, the groove, the mental and emotional groove that's held in the body, or the trigger. It's actually just energy. And then it's a projection of, like, it's my story around it. So we start to work with that. So I had done that practice for a long time, and I really loved it. And I found it
untangling in a very soft way. It's like untangling your inner patterns.
Yes, well said. It really is. It is a slow. It's like, it's very similar to Vipassana. You're looking, you're inquiring, and we use the term vichara, inquiry, the Sanskrit word for inquiring. So we're inquiring into, you know, the nature of our experience, and we're really looking at it and in a place of very safe, secure, a feeling of that you're being held, cradled and supported, and your body is relaxed. And in a sense, because of the way that you can be guided into that relaxation of energy, that into energy that does feel blissful, then it's a way to work with these things that's really safe and loving. Okay, so I did that for a long time and it was really wonderful. But then when yoga nidra really shifted for me, it's when I started to work with the Himalayan master's style. And this is where I think it's very similar to the Tibetan practices of illusory body and dream yoga. And so this, and they will say, you know, oh, they're different. Like if you talk to Andrew, you know, work with Holacek or other people with the dream yoga, they'll say, oh, it's different. But I think if you get, if the yoga nidra, and sometimes that's because they're not practicing yoga nidra, right? And it depends on their guide. Because if you do like a 20 minute yoga nidra or 30 minute on YouTube, you're not there long enough. You have to be 40 minutes at least to, and be guided correctly to get to access the delta state of brain waves, or the delta waves in your brain that start to take you into sleep, okay? Mm-hmm. Into the dreamless, you know, non-REM place. Mm-hmm. So if you hit the brain waves right, to me, it's the same as then being in that state in dream yoga, and then when you're going to clear light sleep, the same practices as in the Tibetan. So there's, you know, there's some argument around. Okay, anyway, I started working with the Himalayan style of working with Nyasa, which is the 61 points of light, and then also after you do that placement of light or mantra or a general, like an order to a body scan to elicit the deep rest in the body, relaxation, then you go to the heart center and meditate. Mm-hmm. Yes. And because the brain waves have slowed down enough to take you into, you know, those delta, you've gone into delta and now you meditate on the heart. And from that place, you can enter into clear light sleep. At least that's been my experience. So, and I've had many students that have encountered that experience and have a real intimate, you know, so that was like the time where, when I discovered the Himalayan master's take on yoga nidra, it was like a revelation, because at this point I was already doing Vajrayana practice. And the it just, wow, this is like a way to understand what I'm actually experiencing in my meditation, in my day yoga practices in Vajrayana. And so I've really fell in love with it. And I'm doing a lot of work and research around it, and also trying to bridge the two together, yoga nidra along with, you know, the lucid dreaming, dream yogas, clear light, six yogas of Naropa, and the illusory body as well, which I think that also really works too for yoga nidra, is the illusory body practices. So I'm really excited about it. I love that you love it. And next year, I'm actually doing a whole 100-hour yoga school, 100-hour yoga training on yoga nidra. So I have been up to now just doing 5-day intensives, but I'm going to be breaking it apart into four of these longer sessions to do 100-hour training. It'll probably be 100+, but... And we will be doing, you know, bringing in, of course, the neuroscience side of things and really looking at the brain and looking at work with trauma. And so I'll have specialists come in all those areas. But the course is, my working title is just that, my super bliss 100 hour, because really when you enter into that experience, to kind of bring us back around to the start, you do really feel... bliss. And it's not it's not just the bliss bunny thing, you know, where a lot of times there's the criticism of yogis as being, you know, hatha yogis as being bliss buddies, just everybody wanting to kind of do practices that are going to make them feel good. And again, that's not lasting. That's not the bliss I'm talking about. So when you brought it out right from the beginning, you know, can you describe it? Well, it really actually is the, you know, the inconceivable and also not very easily describable bliss, because it isn't something that is that you're getting that's outside of you. It's more of like you're uncovering, you're removing all of the things that are in the way of you experiencing what's always been there, because and yoga nidra helps.
I love
super
it.
Super bliss.
Yes. Michelle, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being one of the people that have heavily influenced and guided me in the past couple of years since I've gotten to know you. in the beginning, before when we talked, you're like, you know, I feel you're more of a student of Bob and not of me. I wouldn't say that. I'm definitely, I consider you a very, very dear teacher of mine.
Aww.
And you have opened the door for me for many things. So I want to thank you for this, for being there, for this generosity, for this well of knowledge. And I also want to thank you for being a person that is not afraid to break through some barriers, supposed barriers, and to say, well, I don't, you know, it doesn't conform with this, but I'm going to do it because I think it's beneficial and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and that, by you doing that, you open the door for people like me and many, many other people to also participate in this and to also walk through it. So you're the first through the wall, which makes it easier for us. So I want to thank you for that as well. And please...
You're welcome.
Don't get hit by a bus tomorrow.
Yeah. And hopefully they don't burn me at the stake or something.
If I might have a request, don't get hit by a bus. Don't get burned by the stake. Please stay for a very, very, very long time.
And we're going to be in Hawaii.
Yeah, we have a plan. We have a secret plan to be reincarnated as slugs in Hawaii.
Yes.
So don't forget about it.
I love it. We've
made future plans.
No forgetting that. I'll meet you there in the Bardo.
Yeah.
We're going to be aiming for Hawaii.
Exactly. Hopefully, though, we'll see each other before that.
I hope so, too. You're amazing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, dear.
Vielen Dank auch dieses Mal wieder, dass du zugehört hast bei Meditation Coaching in Life. Es ist mir eine Freude. Wenn du in Verbindung bleiben willst, wenn dich die Themen interessieren, du sie vertiefen willst, dann lade ich dich in unsere Facebook-Gruppe ein. Du findest sie unter Stell dir vor, du wachst auf. Das ist auch der Titel meines Buches, Stell dir vor, du wachst auf, was überall erhältlich ist. Und mein neues Buch, 199 Fragen an dich selbst, erscheint am 14. Dezember. Das kannst du jetzt schon überall vorbestellen. Bis wir uns das nächste Mal wieder hören. Alles Gute. Ciao.